Hi, my name is Angela, and welcome to Crit Club, the podcast where four friends watch a Criterion Channel film that they've never seen before. This week's film is Hirokazu Koreeda's Still Walking, a quiet slice of life film that shares more than the plot suggests. It's a film all about slow wide-angle shots that allow you to become fully immersed in a Japanese family dinner. Before we dig in, let's introduce other members of our panel. We've got Corey.
Hello.
Wizard Chris.
Hello.
And Mr. Peter Allen Clark.
Hey, that's me. Hi.
Hey, that's you. So before I start waxing poetically about how much I love this film and how it is representative of everything that I love about cinema, I would love to hear what everyone else thought about it.
That's quite a thing to follow up with. Angela really likes the movie. Wizard also really liked this movie. This was such like a beautiful like quiet film. Lots of like quiet like intense moments. It's still with me because it reminded me a lot of like, you know, it's a movie that's about family and like dealing with loss and like the things that are like left unsaid between family members that are perhaps better said. And then some things that are said that you're like, Jesus, I wish I didn't know that. There's one scene in particular I think we'll all get to at some point. It reminded me a lot of like my own family relationships that struggle to like communicate and, that sort of, it's funny actually, I watched this at my parents' house, or at my dad's house. And, afterwards I was talking to my dad, and my sister about it. And I was like, it's like a quiet film. It's about like, you know, the things that are left unsaid between families and this and that. And it was intense and emotional and I really loved it. And they were both like, sounds boring. And I was like, that's what the movie's about, guys. That's at least a little bit about what the movie's about. So it came full circle for me. Really wonderful movie. All the cooking scenes are incredible. Like, so much attention to, like, the delicate detail. Like, making friggin', like, corn fritters and all the stuff that goes into, like, hosting, like, a family get-together. This thing where, spoiler alert, that marks, like, the death of the eldest son in the family. This thing that they've done for like 15 years now, and they've just like the whole thing has just run out of gas for everybody except for mom and dad, who like are just seemingly fueled by resentment in keeping this thing together. There's a lot to talk about. I would like to say that I loved it. Somebody else talk about it for
Corey
a bit.
Thought of this. I want to hear what Corey thought of this.
Also, you reminded me, I think we should probably say at the top of an episode, this is every movie that we discuss is spoilers. You know, we're going to spoil everything about
it. Who listens to a movie podcast and is like, I don't want to learn anything about the movie?
There are plenty.
I guess that's fair.
I appreciated this movie more than I enjoyed watching it. So it really reminded me of like some short stories that I was like really like into reading, especially in college and stuff. Like it reminded me of like a really good like Raymond Carver short story or something where there is so much subtext between every line and you almost have to like read the stories twice in order to actually understand even like what's fully going on and stuff. And I felt like that the movie, you know, accomplishes that in a lot of different ways. This is not the kind of movie that I normally watch. And so any sort of criticism that I have for it, I don't think is criticism for the movie itself. It's more about me and my like own personal preferences and what I end up watching and consuming, because I think it does what it does very well. I'm gonna like just start talking about like some of the themes and stuff that I saw, and I also think that there's a lot to talk about. There's a lot going on. Sorry, go ahead, yeah. Peter.
No, it's fine. I was very curious what you thought, Corey, because Angela was spot on with I think she even said on mic or off mic that I would love this movie. And, you know, it's really wonderful to be seen because I absolutely loved this movie. really, really did. But it was like the whole time I was like, I'm really curious what Corey thinks of something like this. Because this is just for everything that Chris said. Yeah, it's like one of these like quiet sort of family dramas that's extremely small stakes, extremely small story. Everything's very contained. And so you get more time to sort of dissect and inspect the interacting relationships between all the characters, between how this family, like, and I think that's why I loved it so much, is because it felt like a family, right? Like, it felt like a family gathering. It felt so I didn't even know, you know, there were, you know, meals and rituals and customs that, you know, felt, you know, a lot, you know, it's a Japanese movie. But it's still, so much of it was so intimately relatable because it felt like, you know, one of those like hokey sort of awkward like family get-togethers where, you know, you and it's much to the writers and the actors' credit that they were able to sort of have this interplay that felt so extremely natural. And I thought it was an enormously textured movie. Chris, you brought up the cooking scenes, mm-hmm. and it's stuff like that that really resonated well. Like from the very beginning, the very first shot is like peeling a radish or I don't know if it was radish exactly, but everything is just, you feel everything, like drops of water and textures and textiles. Like everything is very felt. In a way that it's almost like ASMR for your eyes, and yeah, I don't know.
I think it was regular porn, but
that's very funny. I don't know. Yeah, I have a lot more thoughts. I don't know if you know a lot more thoughts. I think it went on maybe a little long. I could have
done with them cutting right as they were walking up the stairs. I don't think I needed the epilogue.
Yeah, there was.
I needed the epilogue.
Exactly.
Big time.
They were like maybe like 5 or 10 minutes shorter. Like I don't think it was like boring at all. But I think it drifted every once in a while. But I don't think that's much of a critique because overall I just thought it was such a wonderful experience. Angela, what did you think of this movie and how did it compare to other ones you've seen by him?
Oh man, I had kind of forgotten what I loved about cinema. It's just been so long since I was in film school and what inspired me in film school. And this is the kind of filmmaking that does it. You all know me, some of you more than others, but my brain is a just constant stream of reactions to a million things at once. And so when I have a film where things slow down, and I'm given time to process and really look and be invited to look even more deeply at what is seemingly nothing in a frame, brings me immense calm and peace. I also really enjoy kind of natural settings and films that use the setting and slow wide angle shots to immerse you in that environment. One of the things I love about this film is that it's set in the summertime in Japan, which it can get incredibly hot in Japan, like super duper hot, like you don't want to move around. And so it was really cool to watch kind of all the things that Japanese people do to cool down, which is like light incense, actually, which is kind of interesting. And sitting outside with a fan. Yeah. And it reminded me of times when I was visiting family back on the East Coast, like maybe in August or something, and just like being in that heat. And having kind of like that, like not really able to do the things that I want to do because we're visiting family and sort of waiting for the stuff to happen, like the mating, waiting for the meal and watching a taciturn father figure sit around and be grumpy. All of this, even though it was in a different culture, felt very like relatable to me. I feel like even though this is taking place in another country, that this situation is almost universal. Mm-hmm. And so having this kind of quiet filmmaking just gives me so much space to be in those moments and relate on a deeper level to what's going on in the film. And for me, that's the ultimate in escapism and what film should be about.
I just want to take the fan example too, as kind of a stepping point to talk some about the themes. Cause I think it's a very theme heavy, very sort of subtext heavy, film, like him fanning. Like I took that as very much like him just being selfish yet again. Like I think that they set up very early, that
who's
this,
him,
the father,
when you say him,
sorry, the father. Okay. They set up very early that the father is, like you said, very taciturn, very detached, very like not really even a part of this family, although he feels very much like an ownership of the family. I mean, there's a lot of like, you know, patriarchal structures that are going on throughout all of this. I think that almost like at every turn, whenever they do talk about various like gender roles, it's always the men are more or less useless and the women are always the ones doing things. If a man is unemployed, then he is completely useless. And then once he is employed, then it's like this competition and stratification of how useful then are you?
How employed are you?
How much are you doing with your job and how much are you earning? It's very much men are completely useless until they have that. And then that's where they can find their worth. And then that's where their only worth comes from. They can then check the fuck out from everything else, like, and let, you know, everyone else like be the family because they've done their thing. They've done their role. You know, there's one example too, where that I just like really loved. It's not a funny movie. There's very little like laughs in it at all, but there was one where I just kind of like did like a little half smile, a little bit of a laugh where it's, the kids are talking about like what they did during summer, and it's the girl grew a half an inch during summer and she smiles and the boy quit fencing. I'm like,
that was funny.
That is exactly like the theme of the movie. I feel like it's, you know, the girls are the ones doing all the things. But then the boys can quit.
That's so cool. I just thought of that as like enormously great writing of like, this is just a real good family moment. Like this has just felt like a family moment to me.
I kept seeing examples of like men just like not pulling their weight. I mean, he's just like puttering around while everyone's busy, you know, cooking and eating all the time. Everyone, like, they just eat so much throughout all of this, you know. And there's even scenes of like the dad like reading the newspaper while everyone's, you know, sitting around chatting. Anyway,
and that's fascinating because I definitely picked up on those interplays, but I don't know if I identified it as an exact theme. But thinking about it in terms of a theme, it's really interesting to think of the deceased son. What's his name?
Junpei is the dead son.
Junpei,
the golden child.
Yeah, exactly. And like, you know, this, in terms of that theme that you're talking about, this Christ-like figure who died sacrificing himself for this life of this other person.
Well, also continuing his father's business, which is extremely critical to all of this, which is very tiresome. It's one of the things that makes the father such a like unappealing, like exhausting character. Like anybody who wants their children to do exactly what they do is just like, ugh.
But it's funny thinking about in this theme of like the one man who did something, who like was sacrificial or who did like sacrifice of themselves and doing things, is the one that they are all gathered to honor.
Right.
Well, and they're also mad at him though for making that sacrifice.
Yeah.
They're not proud of him, even though it was something very brave and selfless. Mm-hmm. Yep. And you know, it compares to the extent to which the rest of the people in this are very selfish.
And not only are they not proud of him, they're also like torturing this kid for his entire lifetime by continuing to invite him and, you know, make it a point that, you know, he is alive because their awesome son is dead. Like, and they and especially the mother. I mean, I think that like a 2/3 of the way through the movie is when I got really engaged with it, once the mother was able to really truly shine and like sort of like show how she is just cold.
So I think that's probably my favorite scene in the movie, and I think we should probably like break it down a little bit to kind of give everybody an idea. So Junpei, the eldest son who is dead now, he dies saving a boy named Toshiko. Yes?
Yeah. Toshiko.
Toshiko's the mother's name. Anyways, he dies saving a boy. And then, so the family, by way of like dealing with their grief, they invite this boy to dinner once a year. And it's been 15 years, I think, is how long this has been going on. Mm-hmm. So they invite him to dinner every year for 15 years, and it's terrible. He shows up at dinner, and, like, he's obviously meant to be, like, this friggin', like, anime caricature. He's, like, fat and sweaty, and he's trying to work in a media company, or he's not achieving. He's not a fucking doctor. He's not Junpei.
I picked up that he was maybe just, like, Xeroxing flyers for events. And
He's a schlub. And they treat him like a schlub, and then the scene, I think, that again my favorite in the movie is the youngest son talks to his mother and says, "We need to stop inviting this guy. This is torture for all of us." And the mother says, "No, we invite him to remind him that our son is dead because of him. Our life sucks, and so his life has to suck too. Yeah. And I just, that's when the movie just like, that was the galaxy brain moment in the movie for me. I was like, this movie is so like, that's like a deep cut, and you can really appreciate how like, how grief can sort of become that kind of monstrous thing where you just like keep playing with this other person's life, like shaming them for not succeeding, like doing this horrible thing, even though you know it's bad, like you want to hurt somebody even more. Oh man, that was ice cold. And that's, I think there's something there about how that's how like deep family cuts. It can make you do some pretty messed up things.
Mm-hmm. What did you guys think? There's some really beautiful shots and scenes around visiting Junpei's grave, and they go to this grave twice in the movie. One time to go just to visit during the family dinner, and at the end of the movie, they are actually visiting. Now that the family, for all intents and purposes, major spoiler, fast forward if you like, that in the epilogue they basically explain that the father died 3 years after this dinner and the mother died soon after the father died. And at the end of the movie, they are visiting the grave. And for me, and thinking about the way that the film is titled, Still Walking, it suggests to me that this family was already dead. Like, they only go to visit this family once a year. And even at the end of the film, you know, the son, remaining son is like... or no, the father is like, maybe they'll come for New Year's. And the remaining son's like, yeah, see, aren't you glad we went now so that we don't have to go at New Year's?
But the son agrees. Like, his father, like, there's moments in the film where it seems like things are going to go, like, the happy ending route, where, like, they'll bond over something. Like, the father is like, oh, like, I've never taken you to a soccer game. Like, maybe you, me, and your shitty adopted kid, who, by the way, they treat like garbage throughout the entire movie. Maybe one day we can go to a soccer game. And the son is like, yeah, that'd be great. We should do that. The mother's like, I've never ridden in a car. And the son is like, yeah, I'll take you for a drive in a car. And in the epilogue, he's like, we don't do any of that.
Yeah.
Not a chance. And you're like, yes, yeah, still walking.
It's like waiting for Godot. It's like, you know, we should leave. Yeah. They do not move.
I was
wondering if, like, still walking, which, you know, can be read two ways. You're either continuing to walk or standing still walking. Like, it can be either, you know, still or still. I was wondering if it had a similar, like, punny name in Japanese or not. I don't know.
Well, but was anybody... struck, like, I was struck with the how much those elderly people walked, and like that stairs, like just the sheer stairs, like it was very like, I felt like that was very obviously very on purpose, but I mean, I know my parents, who are like 10 years younger than that, probably would have a very big, like a very difficult time with like that huge set of stairs. And I thought it was like, this was just part of their daily sort of like back and forth. So I took it as like the huge hill that they climb, or they continue to, the huge amount of work that they continue to do every single day.
Also, I think worth talking about is Still Walking is the title of the song that the mother plays. Is the title of the song that the mother plays, which is kind of like this like little reminder she keeps of her husband's shittiness, his like infidelity and betrayal. And she like plays it for him sometimes and like sits alone and cries. So, you know, it's like,
we had to watch that scene twice.
We had to watch that scene twice to like, when he's Corey picked up on it. I was like, hey.
Yeah, we were watching the bathtub, or when he's in the bathtub, and she just kind of like, he's like, where did you get that record? You know, where's that from? And she kind of like tells the story, but it's like so, and then he starts like getting really upset. I'm like, did she just like call him out on cheating like forever ago? And we had to like watch it again and be like, yeah, that happened.
That's what happened.
It's so like subtly written.
It's like you were listening to that song and talking to some woman behind a door, and so I left and got the record for you, you son of a bitch.
Oh, wait, back to Angela's original question about the gravesite. I did, like, that was enormously touching for me. And that's something I've got sort of written down to maybe discuss a little later of, like, I'm not sure if this is a cultural custom to pour water on top of the gravestone, mm-hmm. but the sheer, her saying this water must feel good after, like, the hot day was moving to me.
Yeah, there's a cemetery here in Oakland. It's a lot of people from Japanese descent out here in the Bay Area, and they give you little buckets for water.
Oh, I didn't know that. But yeah, the line of how it must feel good on this hot day was just really hit me, really hit me hard. Angela, what did you think of the gravestone, the grave sites?
For me, that the way that they are essentially, that last scene shows what has changed, even though these parents are dead. The older son has gotten another child, and they're all dressed up. And they look very appropriate, and they're, you know, when you're right, as they're pouring that water on, it suggests to me that, like, even though these relationships we have with our family are complicated and in many ways unresolved and still painful, there are traditions that continue in spite of them, and that mm-hmm. perhaps because of those traditions, we should continue to walk with our families and connect with them. And to the extent where I actually think this film is a criticism of modern life and how disconnected we have become from one another for very good reasons, and that we should try to connect more because we're actually more on the same page than we are at odds with each other. And when I heard that line about the, you know, pouring the water on the grave, that's what it evoked for me. And then just later on, when another butterfly appears, and, you know, the son retells the story of the, you know, the reason why a butterfly is yellow, it just further reinforced that idea for me.
And see, and I, because I don't think, to me, I didn't read it as critiquing any sort of disconnect, because everything was so understandable about it. And I think that's what, like, I can say about this movie all in total, is how I understood everything, like all of the motivations, all of the deep hurt, all of that sort of thing. And I personally related a lot to Rio, the sort of, I guess, centrally focused character of just like, because I have this sort of, not to get too personal about it, but I do have like sort of a disconnected sort of relationship with my family and going back home and like there's that like guilt of not going back home, which makes me want to go home even less. And, you know, it's just like this self-perpetuating sort of circle of shame and guilt that just kind of never, ever ends.
And he's also like super tall, and the house, like all the doorways and everything, like he's always having to like duck under, like he feels physically uncomfortable. And I think they really make a point to show how he's just even physically like not built to be there and be uncomfortable when he is there.
I agree. And that's what I like, is all those really small details and nuance that, you know, this isn't a story heavy on plot, but it is a story heavy on detail. And it's just all about being aware and attuned to it and picking it up. And it's one of those weird things where, like, sometimes the whole story doesn't really become apparent to you until the movie is over. And you start remembering the movie and picking up on those details. And almost immediately after watching, it becomes an even richer film, at least for me, it did.
Definitely. Like, even, like, Junpei's death, like, the thing that brings them all together is, like, super understated. Like, you have to piece that together from, like, oh, they talk about him and he's not here. And you eventually are like, oh, okay. And then you find out how. And then you meet the boy. And then it all, like, everything just, like, slowly, like, tinkles into place. You're like, oh, okay, what a horrible tragedy. Of course everyone's damaged, and like everyone coming like descending on this like very traditional looking home that's too small for everyone except the parents. Nobody wants to be there. There's the scene, like, the sister comes off fairly well with her parents, with everybody, and then there's the scene as they're driving home, they're like, oh man, I'm so glad that we left and didn't stay the extra day, like, let's never do this again. Like, everyone has that same reaction to it. Let's never do this again. And one thing that I'm sort of curious about in regards to that and, like, how the epilogue is sort of framed is, do they continue to do this after what we see? are there like three more years of shitty dinners before father finally kicks the bucket and then mother finally follows?
Did you all not feel like it had any sort of growth towards the? I mean, like, it felt like at the end of their trip together, there were at least some slight bridges, slight connections formed. Maybe not lasting ones, but like, you know, it was a nice trip to the beach. It was a nice invitation to like go see a soccer game together.
But like, they didn't do it, and they didn't ride in the car. And,
like, everyone's too bitter.
I feel like dad got like knocked down a peg. Because he's always just like, doctor is so noble. And then, like, he, like, fails at being a doctor and someone gets
pushed
away.
We should definitely discuss that. That scene, like, I'm not even 100% sure, like, how to digest that scene. So someone calls the former town doctor in the night, complaining of chest pains. And he says, no, I can't help you. Even though he has spent the entire movie telling everyone about how it's great to be a doctor, and what
a
hero.
I think it's the theme of men being useless. I mean, I think that is something that keeps men are just useless, even when they like try to puff themselves up or whatever with these like you know various things that make themselves so proud. They're still at the end of the day like useless.
It was so strange to me to see him like refuse to help somebody, and then he's standing there, and then, you know, he's like puttering around the ambulance after they show up and they're like loading the neighbor in, and he's just like, what's going on, like, what's this, what's that, like, he's like just sticking his head in the ambulance and like,
he's in the way,
like this kind of like impotent figure all of a sudden, and like throughout the film, like he's never presented, he's distant and he's very like, you know, patriarchal, but he's not like a powerful seeming character. Like everyone just kind of shunts him off to his little office where he's like super bitter and like he tells anyone who will listen how great it is to be a doctor. I don't know.
I think he wants to be powerful. I mean, there's that line where he's like, why do you all call it grandma's house? My work paid for this house. I'm just like, fuck you, loser.
My reaction. I thought that was like not a low point or anything. Cause again, it's like kind of under, he's like, well, you should probably call an ambulance. Like, no, I can't help you. Like, honestly, like it's probably a good idea to call an ambulance. It's just like, that was his moment to shine. In a series of like missed opportunities to like be a grown up, and I was just, that one landed with me more than any of them, because I'm like, dude, this is supposed to be your thing. Like,
well, I think that's showing how much of how much of this is an artifice, how much of this is like him having to puff his own self up. Like he's probably dealing with all his own insecurities and stuff, and so he's trying to like convince himself that, you know, being a doctor was a noble use of his life now here at the end of his life and stuff. And so I see it as all his ego, and then once
Angela,
his ego
gets
pushed to the test, like his ego just bursts and it's like, oh.
Angela, you made a face, and I'd love to see what caused that face.
I don't know exactly. I'm trying to remember, or I came up with an idea about the grandfather and the whole doctoring thing, but I forgot it, and now I can't remember. And I'm mad at myself for forgetting, so that was my face.
That's okay. It happens. I'm curious, on this line, though, I'm curious about what you all, because I was hoping this would sort of happen, and it's amazing to see how much more sympathy, not sympathy, but, like, I'm at least a little, kinder towards the patriarch, or, like, have, like, not, I don't know, like, maybe sympathy is the right word. I don't know. I just understand a lot of his, like, pettiness and whatever. But what did you all think about... life is rough, y'all.
Yeah, like you can understand why that would like take the wind out of your sails, like losing your prize boy. Like that can totally, yeah, I get it.
Yeah. Wait, I'm curious. So, but I was like rooting for this to happen, and then it happened, and it was the patriarch forming the little sort of like bond with the son of his, you know, daughter-in-law, I guess, you know, Rio's wife's son from a previous marriage. What did you all think of that sort of connection between those two?
Wait, remind me of what the bond was. It's not.
No, it was like, it was just like they, because the patriarch, the dad and the son, who is like a very quiet boy, mm-hmm. who's not included in any of this stuff. I just saw and found a lot of value in the doctor grandpa dude sort of like having conversations and having sort of trying to have moments with that boy that he was not trying with any other person of that family.
I just remember him trying to convince him to become a doctor.
Well, no, for sure, right? But it's like, I thought that was very telling of, like, because he wasn't making those connections with his actual sort of grandchild, right? You know, mm-hmm. he wasn't, like, with the boy, like, it felt like there was definitely, and I really feel like there was a definite establishment of a bond between these two people, and I was trying to figure out, like, what that was. And maybe it's the fact that both of those people, both this son who's not related by blood at all, and this father who's so purposefully removed from the family, they're both the two most outsider people of the whole family. Mm. In a way, I don't know, I was curious if you all had any thoughts about that.
Well, I mean, also, didn't the grandfather guy admit that one of his parents died when he was young, and that's why he became a doctor? And so he really related to this little kid whose father has died, and that's why his mom has remarried into this family. I think that he did feel some sort of true relation, because also if we think about it, this guy doesn't seem happy in his marriage, right? And he was clearly like doing things with other ladies. So maybe there's a part of him that just doesn't like this entire group of people. And
he liked Junpei. Like, everyone liked Junpei.
But I finally remembered what I was going to say earlier about the ambulance thing. What I love about that situation was that actually at that point in the film, that's when you would have like some big climax. You know what I'm saying? Like some big situation where somebody, a male protagonist usually, will save the day. Well, in this film, there is a disaster that happens, and yet that's not what happens. The day is not saved by any of the characters in this film, really. And I thought it was also a good comparison to his own son, Junpei, who did risk himself and died. Mm-hmm. And so part of me thinks that he chose not, like, clearly this guy was going to have to, like, maybe do some serious walking on major stairs or whatever to try to help this person. And he could have put himself at risk because he's so old and could have had a heart attack himself. So I think that it's this situation serves two purposes. It's a commentary on film structure, and that you don't have to have like this big hero save the day to have a story, and also elaborates on how the death of Junpei has affected this family and society at large, because this doctor isn't going to put himself at risk.
Mm-hmm. Like the hero saving the day portion of that particular story occurred off camera, like 15 years ago.
I did not see it as him not willing to take a risk. I saw it as like seeing through the artifice of his own like pompousness about being a doctor. I don't know.
I think that could be it too.
It's just, why not both? Yeah. I think that's fascinating though. The idea that like, that, you know, the lesson that he learns from his son's sacrifice is don't help anybody ever. And you should be a dick to strangers all the time.
There's a lot of anger about like why did, you know, they're angry that why did Junpei die to save this other person, and when they go to the beach there's a ship that has gone aground in the distance, and they're like, yep, that's just there, we're not going to do anything, we're not even going to look at it.
Yeah, he's not a good dude. And even like with all that pain and all that stuff, like it's not, and it did remind me of, but I don't know. The whole thing just felt very, I just related to so much of it in so many ways, because it's that same thing of like, it's not instilling good patterns and good like ways of thinking within your own children, but also expecting them to be together. And I return again and again to just the guilt and the shame of not wanting to spend time with family and not wanting to be around this loss, while also feeling a deep need to do so.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, yeah. Like struggling to make connections because, like, you all share this like loss in common. Like, you're like, I want you to see me, and I want you to communicate with me on that like emotional level. Like, can we try and reach a kind of understanding through our like shared loss, since we're family and stuck together or what have you? And it's frustrating it's frustrating that that doesn't always happen. I don't think that makes this movie frustrating, because, again, Peter, I think you're right when you're like, I understand everybody pretty well in this movie and everyone's motivations. So the movie's not frustrating, but it is frustrating, I suppose, that life is like that. And the movie captures that really well, that, like, you actually don't necessarily learn anything through shared loss. You don't necessarily come together except out of a sense of obligation, which, you know, is that sense of obligation really, like, runs through the film. They come together to acknowledge the death of this of their brother and son, and they will make the trip to acknowledge the death of mom and dad at the end of the film. Yeah, I don't know if there's any point to that. Life is frustrating, and as Japanese cinema goes, this is a really excellent way of capturing that, like, ah, life is frustrating moment.
Well, but, like, not speaking of Japanese cinema, I think this was very surprising to me to see this style of movie done in such a way, because I associate this style of movie a lot with American directors, specifically. I mean, this is like just a, you know, John Cassavetes, Joe Swansburg, like Elaine May, like this is that type of very intimate sort of like quiet patient family drama stuff that I have seen a lot more out of that. And I'm curious, is this what the rest of his movie, like, I've never seen any creative movies before. Angela, how does this compare with his other works that you've seen?
So I saw a lot of his work from the 90s, and I've just been so out of it with film since for a long time that I haven't seen most of this stuff, but I've heard that Shoplifters is exceptional. I mean, he's won some awards from the Cannes Film Festival.
Yeah, that won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, right? Yeah.
So I really want to see that. But in the past, I've seen Mabarossi, which is just haunting. And that one is also a slow burn kind of movie. And then Afterlife is a little more quirky and cuter and also more closely shot. But there's still this kind of slow tone that, to me, trusts the audience and also trusts the cameras to do what it does to tell the story. Like, it's not rushing around and, like, kind of stuffing everything in your face. It's just so subtle. And I'm probably going to watch both of those movies again. I'm going to probably put some serious coin towards even purchasing these movies, because I'd probably watch them again and again. I love them so much. They feel like a comfortable escape, but an escape that still allows me to reflect on my own life and try to do it better.
And I think there were, like, a number of... I've only been in Japan for a total of, like, 14 days in my life. But it's there were, like, a number of things that were, like, very, like, American, that, or at least that I associate mostly with American, that I don't necessarily associate with Japanese. Like one of the first things they do is, like, go out and buy milk. And I'm like, there's not a lot of milk in Japan, is there? Like, I don't know. And then, like, corn... Like the corn fritters, that's, you know, obviously from the Americas.
I have to admit, yeah, I thought, I was surprised to see corn. I was like, oh, like, I guess they would have corn in Japan. Yeah. There's no reason they wouldn't.
I got some corn in, like, some ramen soup or whatever, but, like, for the most part.
And
like,
then they get American. Taco Bell. And then there was that scene at Taco Bell, which is just so weird.
But then, Japan, but then they, like, all talk about, like, RVs. They're talking about, like, buying RVs. And I'm like, is that a part of, like, that seems like a very American thing. I don't know if the Japanese are generally into RVs. But then, like, the watermelon, which is obviously, like, those are pretty rare in Japan, and they're, like, very, Frida told me they were, like, very expensive, and so, like, we Googled it, and it's like, yeah, they're, like, the equivalent of, like, $40 or $50 American for, like, a watermelon there, and that's his gift, and then the kids just go out and beat it until it bursts open. Maybe that's the custom, I don't know, or maybe that was symbolism, I'm not sure.
I don't know, I feel like, you know, if we recall that you know, we defeated Japan in World War II. And so I think there is, you know, in Japanese culture, quite a bit of discussion about the extent to which American culture has impacted Japanese culture. And I think what this film is saying is that maybe some of the American expectations of family and modernism have had a huge impact on the Japanese family, and maybe that needs to be revisited. But that also problems within Japanese culture, like sexism, have also impacted the family. I think for me overall, this film asks the Japanese people to take another look at how they treat each other as a family, and not just their own tiny family, but themselves as a culture and a larger family within their culture.
That's just fascinating to me, because this seemed like any family I know of now. Like, this this didn't seem like their family dynamic didn't seem at all exceptionally Japanese to me personally. It's fascinating.
I guess that's the family dynamic at play globally.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree.
Tips for, if we're looking for other family dramas out of Japan, Yasujirō Ozu does not exclusively like family dramas, but that kind of Japanese family story. I recommend Tokyo Story. It's like about an old Japanese couple who go visit their children in the big city, and it's about like modernism conflicting with like how people get down in Japan normally, and I think that's probably worth checking out for people who are interested in such things. There was a cat. She walked across the keyboard.
Wait a minute, though. I just want to come back real quick to the idea that this wasn't a comment on, like, it is a comment. This is a lot of this is universal family drama, right? But I do think that there are some issues in Japan that they're processing, because like the birth rate in Japan is hugely low. Mm-hmm. I think that there is a certain amount of concern because their culture is aging so much. You know, how do families take care of each other, and how will this society take care of itself as well? So I wanted to.
The movie does kind of actually, now that you mention it, Angela, the movie does kind of present family as like a potential dead end, like emotionally, spiritually, just all around. The movie has a feeling like family's not where you're going to get your kicks, people, which I thought, I mean, that might have been unintentional, but there was definitely like a dead endedness to the idea of family present in the movie.
And I would push back a little bit about that, because I think some of the lightness, some of the welcome lightness that I saw, and I was very glad because it could have gone either way, was found between the relationship between Ryo and I forget her name, the character's name, but his widowed wife, his new, you know, I liked their relationship. They seemed to have a light, easy time together, and I appreciated their bond, especially as a counterpoint to Ryo's parents' bond, right?
Yeah, their bond seems warm, and like he's like kind of, you know, like he's between jobs right now, and he's doing a lot of whinging about his relationship with his dad, but it's also
Seemed like a fuckboy. Oh yeah,
sometimes he doesn't come off well. He definitely doesn't come off as the adult in the relationship all the time, but they're working on it, and I thought that their chemistry, I thought that they really broadcasted that, like, this is newish, they're working on it. He's trying to bond with the son, Atsushi. They're working on it, and they seem unencumbered by like those like resentments and all that bitterness that kind of exists between pretty much everyone else.
The conflict is in the family.
It's like a family thing that he obviously wants no part of, or at least he's like over it, which is understandable because the dad is also over it. He just seems he's done, you know.
It's like when they walk in, he's like, "Oh, you're here," and then he walks off. Setting the stage of how he feels about it.
Reminds me of, this is a deep cut, he reminds me of Ben Gazzara's character in the Todd Solondz movie Happiness. It's just like an old man who is like over it. He's like, I don't feel anything, I just want to be done, I want to be alone all the time, fuck it. It's just like the ultimate nihilism of old age, like I want to sit and read the paper and just seethe around my family.
You know, there's some other, if you like this kind of film, there's some great shows on Netflix that are also kind of in this style. There's Midnight Diner, Tokyo Stories, but then there's also the saucier just Midnight Diner, which is basically stories about strippers at a diner, which is great. And then on top of that is also, I think Samurai Gourmet is pretty amazing too. That's about a retired salaryman who indulges in amazing meals that remind him of his childhood. And I love that. That's one of my all-time favorite things on Netflix. And then also Japanese Style Originator on Netflix is actually a cultural show about Japan for Japanese people and the outsiders who live there. And that is super fun, especially the episode about like the things Japanese people do in summertime to stay cool. It really kind of helps you get immersed in watching Japanese culture. You understand it a little bit more because you've watched some of these other things. So if you like Still Walking, check those out.
I also while we're on recommendations, I would also like recommend the TV series on Netflix, Easy.
Yeah.
Have you all watched Easy?
No. Yeah. But that's a Joe Swansburg thing.
Yeah.
That's why I was just like, Angela, have you watched any Joe Swansburg movies? Like, he was part of like the mumblecore uprising in like the early aughts out of Austin, and he's sort of done a lot of those things around that. Like, Happy Christmas is an excellent movie. Drinking Buddies is a wonderful movie. Like, but these are all exactly this movie. Like,
well, his movies are just still walking. Well, I need to watch that, but I have watched Easy, which I love. I love that show so much. Yeah, it's really good. Gotta watch that.
Yeah, I've been going through a lot of like 1970s Elaine May, John Cassavetes over the past like 6 months or so, and like there's a lot of John Cassavetes that I want to watch, but like but all of these sort of remind me of that, those same things as well, of just like these tight, focused little character dramas that aren't, I don't know, that feel a lot more improvised than actually scripted out.
So shall we get to the
relationships that are just on display rather than
scoring
specific
of this film?
Set pieces of drama and big
scoring
sensational
part of
moments?
I'll go last. Everyone else go.
Shall we roll?
Let's roll.
Yeah, I'll go.
I'm probably gonna be the lowest. I'll start with the lowest, so you all can seem like the better people for rating it higher and appreciating it more. Again,
I appreciated this movie.
I appreciated this movie more than I enjoyed watching it, and I think that it's just not usually the kind of movie that I would watch. I say that. When I was watching it, I felt, and this the scores are always a reflection of I think each of our individual people. We're not trying to create some sort of objective qualifier of it. When I was watching it, I felt very neutral. So I felt just very ten about it. Peeling back the layers.
You had so much to say about it.
Peeling back the layers, thinking about it.
You're full of shit.
Acknowledging the skill that went into it, and to you know, craft the characters and the writing and all that stuff. I'm bumping it up 2 more points to a 12. So I think I'm comfortable giving it a 12.
What?
How kind
this
of you.
Beautiful,
how kind
skillful,
of you.
Skillfully what made a, thing that I feel nothing about.
I felt neutral, but
guy.
I appreciate it. So that's just, hey man, I don't have to
I loved all of your thoughts.
All.
It's so surprising, like, when you feel, it sounds like you're giving a gift to him, like, well, okay, here you go.
Here's two bits for making me feel something.
It's just surprising to me, Corey, because it sounds to me like just this conversation makes it sound like you really enjoyed this movie more than maybe even you realized.
I enjoyed picking it apart more than I enjoyed watching it.
It's a movie kind of movie. You can peel the layers, you can take it apart like a puzzle. The Hellraiser cube. I will throw my hat in. This is a great movie. It really, like, you know, it made me cry a little bit, which was surprising.
Same.
It made me feel lots of things, and it was beautifully shot, and I don't know, everybody did a great job. Super props to just like sad mom character who quietly like carries her resentment in her kimono sleeve. I give this thing I give this movie a 17. I thought it was dynamite. I'm trying to get more conservative with my roles.
Hey, if you're a lover of things, then just love.
I just need a place. I need like a place to go. Like the ceiling is. I accidentally set the ceiling too low. So, but we'll figure it out.
Man, that actor as well, like the woman who played the mother. I mean, because that scene of just her revealing her just deep well of malice, because mm-hmm. She just, that monologue was, or that scene was just so frankly delivered. Like she didn't feel like she was doing anything wrong, and she didn't feel like she was just stating things so matter-of-factly that gave the word so much more weight to me. I don't know.
It's another tradition that they picked up, but not a good one.
I'm also going to give it a 17. I realize I probably should have, I want to watch it again. You all brought up a few things. This was such a wonderful, such a wonderful conversation, and brought up a lot of things that I slipped by me or that I missed that I would love to just revisit. Yeah, I just, again, Angela, I'm just so glad you picked this movie. It's just a wonderful, quiet, textured little thing that allows me to slow down and to really.
I'd also say I appreciate you picking it, and I appreciate everyone's picks, because it's often movies that I wouldn't watch on my own. So I appreciated. And that's the point of having a Crit Club like this. So,
what are you going to give it, Angela?
Yeah. Giving it a 19.
I'm not surprised.
I was going to give it a 20, but I did not cry. And that's kind of my big thing. Like, it has to make me cry bittersweet tears and make me want to change my life. It has...
Like The Land Before Time.
No, more like Amelie. Yeah, that's like my all-time favorite movie, hugely. And every time I watch it, I'm like bawling within like the first 5 minutes. This movie for me, you know, I think everyone has complicated relationships with their families, born of tradition, expectation, and tragedy. And one of our jobs on this planet is to figure out how to be ourselves among all of that, and still understand and accept our families, even if we can't fix them. And, you know, that's something I struggle with now in my 40s, especially having had children. That adds a whole new dynamic to this life mission. But this movie has left me with new ways to try to appreciate those relationships. For that, I'm incredibly grateful. So it gets a 19. If we were doing decimals, I would say 19.5, because as I'm saying it now, I'm realizing how much it's impacted me, and I totally want to watch it again.
If you cry during the podcast, can you bump it up to a 20?
I have it. I'm almost crying, but I'm not, so I can't quite do it. But I did love this movie a great deal. It's also reminded me of everything that I've ever loved about cinema. To the point where I'm like, maybe I should get that master's degree in cinema studies. So, yeah, I'm excited about this, and I can't wait to hear about what our next movie is going to be.
Is it time?
Good segue.
I think it's time. Let's go there.
Yes, that was excellent.
All right. So next episode, our next episode will ideally be our spooky Halloween episode. Angela's doing spirit fingers. You can't see it, but it's awesome. So horror is not necessarily Criterion's strong suit. Nevertheless, I have decided that we're going to watch the 1973 horror comedy film Theater of Blood, starring the unimpeachable, completely amazing, one of my absolute favorite actors, Mr. Vincent Price. It's going to be some really good seasonal ham for the Halloween season. Vincent Price plays a Shakespearean actor who is driven to bloody murder after a brutal criticism of his performance. So there's going to be lots of red poster paint in this one, I think.
And I want to invite our audience.
Yeah, I look forward to sharing it with you guys.
Invite our audience to watch this film. So that maybe by the time we get this up on the web, you know, you'll have some things to say about it, and you can somehow get back to us. We're going to determine how that will work. But eventually we'll want to hear from you all about what you think about the films we've watched.
Cool. And I would say don't sign off quite yet, because I think we're going to be debuting a new feature here on the podcast. What else you watching, basically?
Great.
Chris, did you have anything else to say about your movie pick before we segue to that?
No. Watch Vincent Price movies this Halloween season. Period. Done.
Corey, what else are you watching?
I have a couple things to talk about. So coronavirus, I have been watching a lot of comfort TV, comfort movies and things like that, things that I have loved in the past. And that's typically been my MO, and that's why I appreciate Crit Club getting us to you know, branch out and watch things that I wouldn't watch otherwise. I will often go back to things that I love and make me feel comfortable. So two of my favorite things in the world have recently been taken away from me from streaming services. One is not yet. One is The Office, although I did cancel my Netflix subscription. But Office is leaving Netflix in January, so I bought the box set of that. And also Disney took my Simpsons away. I did have a streaming service, the FX service or whatever, where I could watch Simpsons. And I keep singing that in my head to the tune of KKK took my baby away from the Ramones. Disney took my Simpsons away. So I bought like the box sets of seasons like 3 through 9 of The Simpsons, which I've never had. And I've never listened to a single director's commentary for The Simpsons. So I'm excited to get those in the mail.
There's some great commentaries, like the David Merkin ones, like all of David Merkin's a great voice about that.
I'm excited. I've watched all of those episodes from those seasons infinite amount of times. You know, I know them back and forth, but I'm excited to do the commentary stuff and just have them so that Disney can't steal anything more from me. I did get The Outer Worlds from, which is a video game, from the library, and it's very mediocre, and I just played it one day and have not gone back to it. But then I started, strangely, another very, like, mediocre but well-produced game, Days Gone. It was on sale, on the Halloween sale, for it's a PS4 exclusive. It is post-apocalyptic.
Is that the motorcycle one?
Yeah, you're a motorcycle biker guy in a post-apocalyptic open world with, like, zombies and stuff and, like, you know, various factions and whatnot. And I don't have a ton to say about it because it feels very, like, maybe not AAA, but, like, AA. You know, so it's very well produced, but there's a lot that's very just not super inventive. It feels like Last of Us with no level design. But I do want to, I don't want to talk too long, but I do want to say that I want to talk about the single worst game mechanic that I have ever, I've been playing video games my entire life, the single worst game mechanic that I've ever seen in any video game. And it's the gasoline mechanic in this game, where you have to constantly gas up your motorcycles. Motorcycles are great post-apocalyptic vehicles because they're highly maneuverable and they have great gas mileage. I mean, that's one of their things. Like when fuel is no longer being processed and it is a scarce resource, you can supposed to be able to go very long time on motorcycles. That's one of their pluses. You have to find a gas can and fill it up literally every kilometer. You go 1 kilometer and you've used 65% of your fuel, and it is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in a video game, and it almost makes me want to stop exploring this open world game. That's all.
So if you know who we should write to, about Corey's virtual gasoline problems.
Oh, and while I have all the other video game developers like on my ear, can we please get rid of inventory like encumbrance and weapon durability? These are deeply frustrating things that aren't fun. And both of the games that I've been playing have those things. Anyway, that's me.
Am I supposed to send any messages to any of the game designers please.
Don't think I'm breaking any ground here by saying that no one likes encumbrance.
I don't think you're breaking any ground by being a gamer who's complaining about games. I think the first principles are also.
And while I'm talking about video games, I will say one more thing. I am closer than I ever thought I was going to be to a million and one percenting Binding of Isaac. I have like 3 challenges left, and I have 1 character left basically, and I have a couple things on 1 other character. So I'm probably not going to do it though, because that 1 character that's left, the Keeper, is just the worst. I'll stop talking.
I can see Peter's face. Like, what else are you watching?
Peter's like, you're talking too much, Corey.
we should talk about this off mic about this feature.
Stay tuned for our kick-ass spin-off, Corey's complaints.
My big thing that I was really happy about that was able to put up last week was my yearly roundup of underrated of horror gems, of hidden horror gems that you can find streaming on streaming services. And this year, I've done it the past 5 years that I've been able to put up on different websites or different publications. And this year it went to time.com. And it was 21 movies here. And I'm very, very proud of this year's list because I think there are some wonderful, wonderful movies. But two or three standouts that I would love to just highlight are The Black Coat's Daughter, which maybe isn't too much of a hidden gem. So wonderful, good. Yeah, Kieran and Shipman, Shipka, Satanism, boarding school. That's all you need to know.
It's dark.
And I guess there may be like, I'll only say one more. But Wounds is on Hulu, and Wounds is the best horror movie I've seen this year. Maybe then, and I've seen literally everyone. You can check my letterbox. I've watched over 150 movies this year, and at least half of those, maybe at least one third of those are horror movies. And Wounds is the new movie by Iranian director. What is his name? I'm looking up real quick. His name Babak Anvari, and his first movie was Under the Shadow, which was good. It was a lot more traditional. It was an Iranian movie about the Iran-Iraq war. But Wounds is in a very different movie and a very unsettling one. Yeah, so those are the ones I wanted to mention. Angela, you watch anything else?
So, you know, we're in COVID times, and I'm a mom, and I work, and I do a lot of stuff, and I'm just exhausted. Pretty much. So everything I'm watching right now is all about comfort and relaxation, because anything that doesn't have comfort and relaxation just feels like just a continuation of my regular life, and I'm exhausted. I don't need like just not gonna work with me, and I'm already an anxious person. So now is the Great British Baking Show, which is unveiling every Friday on Netflix. There's a new episode of the latest season, which I understand that the British public is up in arms about, because you know, there's yet another new host, and you know, it's come very far away from the original, but I still enjoy it because for about Fridays I can just be concerned with, you know, is that cake gonna rise, and that's about the stakes that I can handle right now. With a nice side dose of that cute host Noel, I could listen to him talk forever. It's great. To that end, if you like Noel from Great British Baking Show, you can also watch him on the IT Crowd, but very rarely. He's only on like one or two episodes.
Yeah, you're done better watching Mighty Boosh.
That's true.
Which he's one of the main characters in Mighty Boosh.
For some reason, I've never gotten through one, like a whole first episode of that, but I'll try again. I did a little Juliette Binoche Film Festival on the Criterion Channel. I watched Children of the Century, which is about George Sand and one of her lovers. And then I also watched, what was it, Carbon Copy? Is that what it's called? Peter, you watched it. It's one of your favorite. Is it? Bizarre, like a bizarre copy. Movie. And it was one of those things, like Corey said, I don't know that I enjoyed watching it, but I enjoyed thinking about it. And it's a beautiful, beautiful movie. You need a second viewing, I think, to really appreciate it. I appreciate all its virtues. It set me up for one thing and I got a different thing, and that's okay. That was the point. Like, that is the point of that film, to kind of play with your expectations. So I highly recommend, if you like Juliette Binoche, Certified Coffee, and also Children of the Century, which is a delightful period film that doesn't really expand on the boundaries of costume drama, but is still interesting to watch just in regards to its time and feminism and sexism and all that fun stuff. I will stop talking now. Leave it to you, Wizard.
I'm hate watching Ratched on Netflix.
It's very bad.
It's not good. I'm not having fun, but I'm also like, I've got one episode left, so God damn it if I'm not going to finish it. Yeah,
they really should have just called it American Horror Story: Ratched.
Yeah. There are parts of it I like. I love a good evil hospital, evil psychiatry story, a mad doctor thing going on. I really enjoy the actor who plays the head of the hospital. I found him, I found his character like super enjoyable. But it's, I think I maybe don't like Sarah Paulson just as a rule. I think maybe she doesn't engage me. And also the whole thing, obviously I'm bursting. All I can say is that this movie is needlessly like gauche and needlessly like seedy, or this series like needlessly like seedy and not that interesting. Sharon Stone is in it. She's pretty badass. I don't know. Peter, you didn't enjoy it. Did you watch more than one episode?
Yeah. I've made it most of the way in, and then I was just like, okay, this is fine. I don't think we needed. Why did it have to be Nurse Ratched? I just didn't feel like its tie-in with like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
The Nest tie-in, yeah, it's just so.
Is it set? Yeah, in the 60s?
And it's just not necessary.
The same.
Well, yeah, it's like Nurse Ratched. It's like a prequel. It shows itself as a prequel, but it is not. It is a season of American Horror Story.
100%.
It is absolutely a season of American Horror Story. As a person who's watched every single season of American Horror Story, this is another one of those.
100%. Yeah, it's more focused than American Horror Story, but not by much. And yeah, as prequels to like. Cuckoo's Nest is not a book that demands a prequel. It's not a movie that demands a prequel. And this character does not demand a prequel. So, like, if you wanted to make, like, a sort of, like, half season of American Horror Story Asylum, why not just do that? Call it something else.
Well, question, what was the name of the actress who was Nurse Ratched and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
That's Louise Fletcher.
So, fun fact, I'm also watching DS9. And she's in a couple episodes
she's
of Kai DS9.
Wynn, yeah.
She's Kai Wynn. So if you want some Louise Fletcher flavor, which I think is really, she's an incredible actress. She is able to give off like intimidation, like no
very
other.
Very intense woman. Very like, intense steely-eyed woman. Steely-eyed woman.
Go watch some DS9 in the early seasons and you know, get some of that there. I don't think you're going to find it.
Don't watch Ratched. It's Ratched.
I have good feelings about Sarah Paulson, just not maybe in the thing she's been in recently. I think she's done some wonderful work in the past, but I don't know.
I can accept that I'm talking shit because I'm so disappointed in all of the time I've spent watching her do this thing that's not very good.
She's found a lane that I guess works for her, so she wants to stay in that lane, and I'm not going to tell a person what to do with their time.
Fair enough. Are we all done with this episode?
Should we take it in
what
for
are
a
we
landing?
Doing? Yeah. Let's end it.
Well, thank you all for joining us. This was another great hour plus of discussing Criterion Channel films. And we hope to see you next time when we're talking about Wizards film, which the name of which was it? Theater of Blood?
Theater of Blood for Spooky Halloween.
Spooky, spooky, spooky with the spooky spirit hands. Hope you guys have a great weekend. We'll see you next time.
Theater of Blood.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.